This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to News in Review, coverage of the national and world news stories that we don't have time to read during the week. Don't miss out on important information from around the globe. Get it all on News in Review, coming up next on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is News in Review, and I'm your reader, Don, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading national and world news articles from the Journal Gazette, copyright 2025, from September 6th through September 10th, beginning now with articles from September 8th. Bowen Health cuts ribbon on $10 million Warsaw Clinic by Journal Gazette. Bowen Health officially opened its doors Monday in Warsaw of its newest integrated health care clinic, a $10 million investment into Kosciuszko County. Located at 901 Anchorage Point Drive, the clinic has 20,000 square feet, a news release said. The clinic offers expanded primary health care, dentistry, mental health care, addiction recovery treatment, and life skills coaching services. The news release said the multidisciplinary approach to providing health care can make an immediate positive difference in patients' lives. The building really is the next chapter in our relationship with Kosciuszko County, said a statement from Bowen Health President and CEO Dr. Rob Orion. And I would argue it really is about building a place that is for us, for our community. The site is Bowen Health's first clinic that will offer dental services. Dr. Colin Spencer, who will lead the clinic, said dental care is a big deal for many people, and access is important. Spencer also said it will be exciting to be part of a team that can care for patients regardless of their ability to pay. Kosciuszko County Commissioner Carrie Groninger applauded Bowen Health for its continued investment in the community. He said that many veterans in the county have been forced to drive more than 50 miles to receive dental services, and he's glad that it is about to change. I think the true measure of a community's success is its ability to care for its residents, and I think this facility will undoubtedly contribute to that goal, Groninger said in a statement. Mary Martin, representing Governor Mike Braun, shared his statement with the group. This expansion represents an important investment in the health and well-being of Hoosiers, and it reflects your continued dedication to serving our communities with passion and excellence, the statement said. Access to quality care is vital to the strength of our families, our workforce, and our future. This is Bowen Health's third new clinic building completed along U.S. 30, with others located and operating in Columbia City and Plymouth. Construction is underway on new clinics along U.S. 24 in Wabash and Huntington County. Sugar consumption rising as globe warms, study finds by Associated Press. Global warming in the United States is amping up the country's sweet tooth, a new study found. When the temperature rises, Americans, especially those with less money and education, drink lots more sugary beverages and a bit more frozen desserts. It amounts to more than 100 million pounds of added sugar consumed in a year, compared with 15 years earlier, according to a team of researchers in the U.S. and the United Kingdom, writing in Monday's Nature Climate Change. Climate change is shaping what you eat and how you eat, and that might have a bad effect on your health, said study co-author Duo Chan, a climate scientist at the University of Southampton. People tend to take in more sweetened beverages as the temperature is getting higher and higher, Chan said. Obviously, under a warming climate, that would cause you to drink more or take in more sugar, and that is going to be a severe problem when it comes to health. By tracking weather conditions and consumer purchases, the researchers found that sugar consumption rose as temperatures moved between 54 and 86 degrees Fahrenheit. And the warmer it got, the more sugar was consumed, until appetites began to lessen when it grew warmer than 86 degrees. The United States average annual temperature has gone up about 2.2 degrees since 1895, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. To chart the impact on sugar consumption, researchers compared it to the American Heart Association recommendations limiting daily intake to 36 grams for men and 25 grams for women. The team then compared wind, precipitation, and humidity records to the detailed purchase records of 40,000 to 60,000 American households from 2004 to 2019. Not using any data after the pandemic hit, they looked at the nutritional information of the items bought. That allowed them to eliminate other factors to make a causal link and come up with calculation for how much extra sugar is consumed per person per degree, said lead author Pan He, an environmental scientist at Cardiff University. Researcher He said she started thinking about the study when she noticed that people in the U.S. tend to grab sugary soda when they are thirsty. From a perspective of nutrition science or environmental science, that could be a problem, she said. The researchers found that men consumed more sugary soft drinks and that the amount of added sugar consumed during hot weather was several times higher for low and very low income families than for the wealthiest, the study found. People who work outside drank more sugary drinks than those who work inside, and the same went for families where the head of the household was less educated. White people have the highest added sugar effect, while Asian Americans showed no significant change in added sugar in the heat. Specialty plates bring in $200 million. That's over 20 years. 100 groups take part, by Leslie Bonilla Munoz, Indiana Capital Chronicle. Hoosiers have poured almost $200 million into scholarships, medical research, child welfare, and more in less than two decades just by buying specialty license plates for their vehicles. The Indiana Bureau of Motor Vehicles has sold nearly $8 million on behalf of a wide array of organizations between 2007 and July 31st of this year, according to agency data. Upwards of 100 groups participate in the program. Each has its own design and earns up to $25 on every initial sale and annual renewal. You have to get a license plate every year if you're driving a car, said Mary Jane Michalek, Ivy Tech Community College's Senior Vice President of Legal and Public Affairs. And so, if you want to, you can provide support to Ivy Tech at the same time. The institution enrolls about 180,000 students annually. It's something that people can do to support their favorite organizations across the state and help open a new revenue stream for bringing some good works to Hoosier lives, said Special Olympics Indiana spokesman Joe Frollo. The group has 70 county programs with 10,000 coaches and volunteers supporting 19,000 athletes with intellectual disabilities. Indiana Code caps the number of specialty license plates at 150. To get one, a group must submit a detailed application backed by signatures from prospective buyers and survive multiple stages of review by the BMV and state lawmakers. To keep it, the group has to sell enough. Some participants already struggle to meet the signature and sales standards, but new applicants will have to collect double the number of names and make twice the sales. The hikes were nestled in House and Road Act 1390, this year's BMV agency law. Representative Jim Pressel, Republican, Rolling Prairie, wrote it. controlling the amount of them, not going over the cap, not statutorily changing that number, is important because we don't want to dilute the system, Pressel said. We don't want to have 5,000 different license plates in Indiana, he added. So if they're meant to be something special, then they really should be treated like that. Indiana University and Purdue University top the participant list when it comes to revenue, respectively earning about $26 million and $22 million off their plates between 2007 and July 31st. IU has sold more than 1 million, while Purdue is approaching 900,000. Ivy Tech has earned about $373,000 off 15,000 sales over that time period. The license plate is a point of pride for our donors, community members, alumni, and students, Milishak said. It's a way for those who care about Ivy Tech to promote the organization, and it also gives meaningful support back to current students. That's because, under the law, educational institutions must use plate money on scholarships for Indiana residents. For instance, Ivy Tech students who can't meet their total cost of attendance, even after federal and state financial aid is applied, can pull from the college's general scholarships, according to Milshak. State agencies have also benefited in environmental plate funds, land conservation, while a Kids First Edition goes to the prevention of child abuse and neglect. Other big earners include the Riley Hospital for Children at Indiana University Health, the Indiana Breast Cancer Awareness Trust, spay-neuter services, and organizations for nurses, sheriffs, and professional firefighters. The participant list is eclectic, with groups dedicated to conserving wild turkeys, golf, coal, museums, and more. I think it's serving its purpose by allowing folks to support the groups that are important to them, Pressel said. It gives these organizations an opportunity to raise some dollars statewide and then be able to do good things with it. It's also a brand-building opportunity, Pressel likened the plates to small billboards going up and down the road. The Alzheimer's Association Greater Indiana Chapter, which is in its first year of the program, plans to use plate revenue to accelerate treatment research and talk to Hoosiers over social media and in person about the warning signs, risk factors, diagnosis, and treatment options. If you're sitting in traffic on Interstate 465 and see that plate, chances are they probably know someone that's affected by this disease, Sarah Donsbach, the chapter's director of state affairs, said. And we're hoping that will prompt them to Google us or to say, that's a really cool plate. I'd like to put that on my car. Special Olympics Indiana puts its plate proceeds toward free year-round training and competitions for athletes of all ages across a whopping 20 sports statewide. The programming allows Hoosiers with intellectual disabilities to enjoy the camaraderie and the fun of sports and competitions, just like everybody else enjoys doing, Frollo said. Some groups have come under fire, however. The state's second-highest official, Lieutenant Governor Micah Beckwith, and his Anti-Woke Advisory Committee have recommended an audit of the specialty license plate program to ensure participants are complying with anti-DEI executive orders, the Indiana Citizen reported. The committee specifically called out the Indiana Youth Group, which supports young LGBTQ Hoosiers. CEO Chris Paulson told the citizens that the plate revenue helps his group provide food, clothing, and resources for those experiencing homelessness and other financial hardship. BMV spokesman Greg Dunn told the Capital Chronicle that the agency has not performed any anti-DEI audits of program participants. Indiana has other so-called distinctive plates, like the popular Hoosier veteran and Indianapolis Colts team designs, but they are explicitly excluded from the specialty plate requirements. Indiana Capital Chronicle is part of State's Newsroom, a nonprofit nonprofit news network supported by grants and coalition of donors as a 501c3 public charity. Indiana Capital Chronicle maintains editorial independence. Contact editor Nikki Kelly for questions at info@indianacapitalchronicle.com. J.A. of Northern Indiana adding three to Hall of Fame by Lisa Green, the Journal-Gazette. Nearly 460 people are expected to attend a celebration this evening at the Grand Wayne Center, where Junior Achievement of Northern Indiana, Inc. will present its Business and Education Leadership Awards, a spokeswoman said Monday. An entrepreneur who started a retail chocolates business and two steel industry executives will become the newest inductees to the Greater Fort Wayne Business Hall of Fame. Kathy Brandbeer of DeBrand Fine Chocolates and Steel Dynamics, Inc. co-founders Mark Millett and Richard Dick Teets will join a Hall of Fame that started 41 years ago and now has 103 inductees. Abby L. Schimmel, JA's local director of marketing, a longtime banking executive, will also be honored. Mike Eikenberry, described as a community advocate who retired in 2013 as Indiana Regional President of PNC Bank, will receive the Ovi Jorgensen Spirit of Leadership Award. The business leaders' journeys we will celebrate are proof that strong leadership, innovation, and resilience build great companies and strengthen entire communities, Lena Yarian, JA's president, said in a statement. In 1987, Brandbeer said she had about $20,000 in the bank when she bought used equipment and opened DeBrand. Even as Kathy remains focused on creativity and quality in her chocolates, she also stays committed to producing a variety of products, beautifully packaged in different size boxes and in every price range, because she believes everyone should be able to give the luxury of a fine chocolate to themselves or as a gift, J.A. said in a news release. Millett, co-founder, chairman, and CEO of Steel Dynamics, Inc., said it was a fortuitous decision when he, Keith Bussey, and Dick Teets took a $285 million risk and opened their new company with the intent of disrupting the steel industry. Keith was incredibly driven with strong business acumen and background. Dick had a phenomenal engineering ability, Millett told J.A. Our common thread, the desire to build a company with a culture second to none and create opportunities for others. Steel Dynamics, SDI, has more than 13,000 employees across its site. Under Millett's leadership, the company invested $2.7 billion to build a 650,000 metric ton flat rolled aluminum mill and two supporting satellite slab centers to expand into recycled aluminum flat rolled products. Teets' legacy, J.A. said, is grounded in operational excellence, team-first leadership, and relentless drive to prove what's possible when people are empowered to do their best work. In July, SDI reported second quarter 2025 net sales of $4.6 billion. For the Leadership Award, Eikenberry will be recognized for years of service to multiple boards of nonprofits, four foundations, and also supporting J.A. Eikenberry says his fire for supporting others by raising funds, making connections, and sharing advice hasn't burned out. August 10th articles. Christianity's oldest organ plays first time in 800 years by Associated Press. After 800 years of silence, a pipe organ that researchers say is the oldest in the Christian world roared back to life on Tuesday, its ancient sound echoing through a monastery in Jerusalem's Old City. Composed of original pipes down from the 11th century, the instrument emitted a full, hearty sound as musician David Catalino played a liturgical chant called Benedicamus Domino Flos Filius, the swell of music inside St. Xavier's Monastery mingled with the church bells tolling in the distance. Before unveiling the instrument Tuesday, Catalunya told a news conference that attendees were witnessing a grand development in the history of music. This organ was buried with the hope that one day it would play again, he said, and the day has arrived, nearly 8 centuries later. From now on, the organ will be housed at the Terra Sancta Museum in Jerusalem's Old City, just miles from the Bethlehem Church where it originally sounded. Researchers believe that the Crusaders brought the organ to Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus, in the 11th century during their period of rule over Jerusalem. After a century of abuse, the Crusaders buried it to protect it from invading Muslim armies. There it stayed until 1906, when workers building a new Franciscan hospice for pilgrims in Bethlehem discovered it in an ancient cemetery. Once full excavations were conducted, archaeologists had uncovered 222 bronze pipes, a set of bells, and other objects hidden by the Crusaders. It was extremely moving to hear how some of these pipes came to life again after about 700 years under the earth and 800 years of silence, said Koos van de Linde, organ expert who participated in the restoration. The hope of the Crusaders who buried them that the moment would come when they would sound again was not in vain. A team of 4 researchers directed by Catalunya set out on a 2019 to create a replica of the organ. But along the way, said Catalunya, they discovered that some of the pipes still function as they did hundreds of years ago. Organ builder Reinold van der Putten placed those original pipes alongside replicas he created based on ancient organ-making methods, some of which were illuminated by close study of the original pipes. The originals, making up about half of the organ, still bear guiding lines made by the original Ottoman craftsmen and engraved scrolls indicating musical notes. Alvaro Torrente, director of the Instituto Complutense de Ciencias Musicales in Madrid, where Catalunya undertook the project, compared the discovery to finding a living dinosaur, something that we never imagined we could encounter, suddenly made real before our eyes and ears. Researchers hope to finish restoring the entire organ and then create copies to be placed in churches across Europe and the world so its music is accessible to all. Judge tosses case against 15 electors in Michigan. They were accused of falsely certifying Trump as 20 victor by Associated Press. A Michigan judge dismissed criminal charges Tuesday against a group of people who were accused of attempting to falsely certify President Donald Trump as the winner of the 2020 election in the battleground state, a major blow to prosecutors as similar cases in 4 other states have been muddled with setbacks. District Court Judge Kristen D. Simmons said in a court hearing that the 15 Republicans accused will not face trial. The case has dragged through the courts since Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel, a Democrat, announced the charges 2 years ago. Simmons said she saw no intent to commit fraud in the defendants' actions. Whether they were right, wrong, or indifferent, they seriously believed there were problems with the election, the judge said. I believe they were executing their constitutional right to seek redress, Simmons said. Each member of the group, which included a few high-profile members of the Republican Party in Michigan, faced 8 charges of forgery and conspiracy to commit election forgery. The top felony charges carried a maximum penalty of 14 years in prison. Supporters, friends, and family crowded in the hallway outside the courtroom cheered when the judge said the cases would be dismissed. Investigators said the group met at the Michigan GOP headquarters in December of 2020 and signed a document falsely stating they were the state's duly elected and qualified electors. President Joe Biden won Michigan by nearly 155,000 votes, a result confirmed by a GOP-led state Senate investigation in 2021. Electors are part of the 535-member Electoral College that officially elects the President of the United States. In 48 states, electors vote for the candidates who won the popular vote in Nebraska and Maine. Elector votes are awarded based on congressional district and statewide results. One man accused in the Michigan case had the charges against him dropped after he agreed to cooperate with the state attorney general's office in October 2023. The other 15 defendants pleaded not guilty and have maintained that their actions were not illegal. Prominent Republican MAGA activist and former Michigan Republican Party co-chair Michonne Madoc was one of the accused. "We all knew from day one that we had done nothing illegal or wrong," Madoc said in a written statement. "Yes, we volunteered to be an alternate elector in support of Donald J. Trump. This is not a crime as much as Nessel wanted it to be one." The judge said Murdoch's public statements at the time suggested she was seeking redress from her state senators in presenting them with an alternate choice of electors. Nessel called Simmons' ruling disappointing and a very wrong decision during a virtual news conference and said evidence would support criminal charges if the case had been brought before a jury. She said the group members knew their actions did not follow proper election procedure and specifically sought to circumvent the rules. "They knew they were not electors," Nessel said of the group. "They knew Donald Trump lost, but then they lied anyway, and that is the crime." Doctoral student kidnapped in Iraq in 2023 released by Associated Press. A Princeton University graduate student who was kidnapped in Iraq in 2023 while doing research there has been freed and turned over to U.S. authorities, her family and officials said Tuesday. Elizabeth Surkov, who holds Israel and Russian citizenship, spent more than 900 days in custody after disappearing in Baghdad, the Iraqi capital, as she was pursuing a doctorate focused on sectarianism in the region. She was turned over to the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad after having been tortured for many months, President Donald Trump said in a social media post in which he identified her captors as from the Kataib Hezbollah, part of a coalition of Iranian-backed militias that are officially part of Iraq's armed forces, but in practice often act on their own. The U.S. government listed the group, which has not claimed kidnapping, as a terrorist organization in 2009. Surkov's sister, Emma, a U.S. citizen who has campaigned for her release, said she was in Washington for meetings this week when she heard the news from Adam Buller, the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs. "I heard her voice for the first time in 2.5 years and still couldn't believe it. And I just melted on the floor," she said in an interview with the Associated Press. "I heard her voice and she heard mine, and it was the most joyous experience of my life, and we both started sobbing and screaming." Two Iraqi militia officials who spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly about the case said one of the conditions for her release had been the withdrawal of U.S. forces currently stationed in Iraq, which had been agreed upon between Washington and Baghdad last year, and that the U.S. and Israel would not launch strikes on Iraq. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he spoke with Surkov's family and told them the entire state of Israel is happy to see her return home. Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani said in a post on X that Surkov's release was a culmination of extensive efforts exerted by our security forces over the course of many months. Al-Sudani came to power in 2022 with the backing of a coalition of Iran-linked Shiite parties, but since then has sought to balance relations between Washington and Tehran. In a recent interview with the AP, he said he sought closer ties with the Trump administration. Bombing kills Ukrainians in line to collect pensions, by Associated Press. A Russian glide bomb struck a village in eastern Ukraine on Tuesday as people stood in line in the open air to collect their monthly pension. The blast killed at least 24 people and injured 19 others, the Ukraine Emergency Service said. The bomb in the Donetsk region village of Yarnova, about 11 a.m. local time, authorities said. The village lies less than 6 miles from the front line. Donetsk regional head Vadim Fleshkin said 23 of the dead were pensioners. Yarnova resident Hena Dilitrush said his wife was killed in the blast as she waited to collect the pension of her bedridden mother-in-law. Afterward, Trush fled Yarnova with his elderly mother, who was carried on a stretcher. In shock and with soot still on his face, Trush wept as he described the scene of the attack. It was beyond words, he told the Associated Press. Before strikes landed on the outskirts, this time it was right in the center of the village. It was the latest Russian attack to kill civilians. More than 12,000 Ukrainian civilians have been killed in the three-year war, the United Nations says. Frankly, brutal, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said in a post on Telegram of Tuesday's attack, urging the international community to make Russia pay economically for its full-scale invasion through additional sanctions. With U.S.-led peace efforts making no headway in recent months, Russia has escalated its aerial barrages of Ukraine. On Sunday, Russia hit the capital, Kiev, with drones and missiles in the largest aerial attack since the war began in February 24, 2022. In Ukrainian villages where there are no ATMs and other people are unfamiliar with digital banking, pensions are commonly delivered to the local post office on a certain day of every month. Retirees stand in line to pick up their pension in cash. Photos of the scene posted on official Ukrainian channels show bodies lying around, damaged while white car with yellow branding that was parked beneath trees. The vehicle damaged in the attack was a mobile post office. Yerkopolshta Network Development Director for the Dnipro and Donetsk regions, Maxim Sutkovy, said in a phone interview. The head of Ukraine's National Postal Service, Yerkopolshta, said the company constantly changes security procedures. Ibhor Simulatonsky said the car was parked under trees to reduce the risk of it being spotted by the enemy, but apparently someone gave away the coordinates, Simulatonsky wrote on Facebook. Supreme Court quickly to take up tariffs case, by Associated Press. The Supreme Court granted an unusually quick hearing on President Donald Trump's sweeping tariffs Tuesday, putting a policy at the center of its economic agenda squarely before the nation's highest court. The justices will hear the case in November, a lightning-fast timetable by the Supreme Court's typical standards, and rule at some point after that. The tariffs will stay in place in the meantime. The court agreed to take up an appeal from the administration after lower courts found most of the tariffs illegal. Freeze of $5 billion in foreign aid upheld, by Associated Press. Chief Justice John Roberts on Tuesday temporarily kept in place the Trump administration's decision to freeze nearly $5 billion in foreign aid. Roberts, acting on the administration's emergency appeal to the Supreme Court in a case involving billions of dollars in congressionally approved aid, President Donald Trump said last month he would not spend the money, invoking disputed authority last used by a president 50 years ago. The order is temporary, though it suggests the justices will reverse a lower court ruling that withholding the funding was likely illegal. September 6th articles, New Mall Owners Bullish About Glenbrook Square by Lisa Green, the Journal-Gazette. The U.S. map on Hull Property Group's website has dots in the north, the south, and in between, marking where it operates U.S. shopping malls with some familiar names in its tenant rosters. In Racine, Wisconsin, Hull Properties Regency Mall includes a Bob's Discount Furniture, Ross Dress for Less, K Jewelers, and Lens Crafters. A Target and Olive Garden are among the retailers and restaurants on outparcels near Regency. Hull Property also owns Citrus Park Town Center in Tampa, Florida. The attractions there include Macy's, JCPenney, Dillard's, Dick's Sporting Goods, and for shoppers with appetite for gourmet burger or other food, restaurants including Red Robin. Hull Property Group will work with some of the same businesses that have a Fort Wayne presence as it takes over Glenbrook Mall. The company, based in Augusta, Georgia, announced August 29th that it had acquired the sprawling Fort Wayne Shopping Mall at Coldwater Road and Coliseum Boulevard. John Mullahern, a Hull property executive, said during a telephone interview that Glenbrook Square is more than 90% occupied. You have a lot of national retail, and it's all located right there in that corridor. We are so bullish on Fort Wayne because of that, Mulheron, Hull Properties Vice President of Government Relations, said the day after the Glenbrook Square sale closed. I'm rooting for our neighbors, the neighboring properties, to be as successful as us because the high tide lifts the boat, Mulheron said. Glenbrook Square benefits from a high-traffic intersection with dozens of businesses that draw customers who still like in-person shopping and dining and experiences. An average of 4,400 vehicles daily travel the Coliseum Boulevard stretch between Speedway Drive and Coldwater Road, according to a traffic map the city of Fort Wayne keeps. An average 29,500 vehicles daily travel the North Coldwater Road stretch heading south between Collins Road and Coliseum Boulevard. Glenbrook Square had been in receivership since 2022 due to a bankruptcy process. Leasing and management was being handled by Spinoso Real Estate Group of Syracuse, New York. Mulheron said his firm believes it's up to the task of running Glenbrook, which has more than 1 million square feet. Fort Wayne isn't Hull Properties' first foray into Indiana. It bought Richmond Square Mall nearly 10 years ago in December 2015, Mulheron said. And in January last year, Hull Property bought Muncie Mall. Sharon Wagley, executive assistant to Muncie Mayor Dan Ridenour, has family in Tampa and has visited the mall Hull Property owns there. She and others in Muncie look forward to the mall evolving into more of a shopping destination. Just fairly recently, I had a citizen from Muncie call and say, I wish we could redo our mall like Richmond has redone their mall, and that's one of Hull's, Wagley said by telephone this week. Muncie Mall had been up for sale for years after former owner Washington Prime Group stopped paying the mortgage in 2020 when all its anchor stores had left, according to a January 31st, 2024 report by Wish TV in Indianapolis. A year later, Washington Prime Group filed for bankruptcy protection, the article said. The Muncie Star Press in June 2020 announced JCPenney included stores at malls in Muncie and Richmond among nearly 155 locations it planned to close permanently as part of a Chapter 11 bankruptcy in January 2020. Macy's had already confirmed its plan to close its anchor store at the Muncie Mall, the newspaper reported. In Richmond, the president of the Economic Development Agency, Valerie Schaefer, was already working with the Economic Development Group of Wayne County when Hull Property acquired the mall there. There were several recent stores fronts from smaller retailers closing over the years, she said. We're very fortunate to still have a Dillard's here. The Richmond Mall, like Glenbrook Square, lost a Sears anchor store at the retail chain's overall financial and operating challenges intensified and led to bankruptcy. Few states today have a Sears department store. In Fort Wayne, a Bob's Discount Furniture and a Home Goods are among the retail businesses now operating in newly constructed space where Sears was. In Richmond, the former Sears location was refashioned to a Dunham Sports. Schaefer said Hull Property has done a fantastic job of stabilizing the mall and improving its aesthetics inside and out. This has included a new roof, fresh paint and carpet in areas, and using wallboard to have murals with community and locally historic images cover empty storefronts where some malls would simply use metal gates as barriers. We have a lot of strip malls throughout the community, but I think having a mall adds to the community, Schaefer said. It still provides a great shopping experience. Stephen Zacher, president and managing broker with the Zacher Company in Fort Wayne, said a lot of shopping dollars have shifted from traditional department store anchors to big box stores. Those include Walmart and Meijer, where shoppers can get groceries, household items, furniture, and electronics. Even Kroger, Zacher noted, has expanded over time from just groceries to carrying more non-food items. Shoppers, he added, also are paying for memberships at discount clubs like Sam's and Costco, which offer food and a range of items. Glenbrook Square still has clout, though. Glenbrook is still the strongest regional retail pull by far, I think, said Zacher, whose company tracks vacancy rates in areas such as retail and office space. Jefferson Point is strong, but by far, I think Glenbrook is stronger. The occupancy rate of more than 90% that Hull Properties Mulheron said Glenbrook Square has is within the norm, according to information the ICSC, which represents shopping centers, provided this week. Occupancy has been trending down the last 10 years, based on tracking by the ICSC and the National Council of Real Estate Investment Fiduciaries. 10 years ago, enclosed malls that had an average 93.8% occupancy rate. That dropped to 85.5% in 2021 during the COVID-19 pandemic, that led to weak sales for many businesses with brick-and-mortar locations. Since that low point, occupancy has gradually improved, the tracking shows. Stephanie Sigaliski is Vice President of Research and Public Relations for the ICSC, formerly known as the International Council of Shopping Centers. Successful shopping centers recognize that physical and digital retail are not in competition, but are symbiotic, Sigaliski said in an email response. Today, consumers not only want options, but want seamless experiences both offline and online, with services like buy online, pick up in store, and curbside pickup, she said. Successful shopping centers are also prioritizing experience-driven tenants, which turn shopping trips into social outings and can't be replicated online. The Loss of Legacy Anchors is an opportunity for both mall owners and retailers in today's tight retail real estate market, Sigaliski said. She also believes the overall outlook for enclosed malls is positive. Malls have been able to reimagine and reinvent massive underutilized spaces, from residential communities to modern office spaces to experiential retail concepts. Those former anchor spaces are being redeveloped for new and innovative uses, Sigaliski said. Shopping centers are not just a place to shop anymore, but are transforming into community hubs that offer consumers a curated mix of experiences, dining, entertainment, shopping, and services, she said. Hull Properties Mulheron said his company focuses on meeting needs, including marketing and enhancing the look and feel of its properties. The company has 36 enclosed shopping malls across 17 states. Hull Property wasn't allowed to talk with the mall's tenants before the acquisition closed August 28th, Mulheron said, but representatives from his company are expected to return Tuesday to Fort Wayne to make sure in-person connections. Mulheron said the company wants to work collaboratively with tenant leadership and the community. Some meetings Tuesday could include talking with city leaders if scheduling allows. The emphasis on tenants, though, is primary, and Mulheron said he recognizes that Glenbrook is totally different than Muncie or Richmond. Success for Hull Property means seeing tenants increasing their sales, and we're going to work with our tenants in any way possible, Mulheron said, to help them increase their sales. If that happens, tenants are more likely to renew leases, he said. Every property is unique, and every property and community has its own sets of challenges, Mulheron said. But here's the one thing that does not change, is that we're good stewards of our property. Scientists tap secret fresh water under the ocean, by Associated Press. Aboard Liftboat Robert, North Atlantic deep in Earth's past, an icy landscape became a seascape as the ice melted and the oceans rose off what is now the northeastern United States. Nearly 50 years ago, a U.S. government ship searching for minerals and hydrocarbons in the area drilled into the sea floor to see what it could find. It found, of all things, drops to drink under the briny deeps. Fresh water. This summer, a first-of-its-kind global research expedition followed up on that surprise, drilling for fresh water under the salt water of Cape Cod. Expedition 501 extracted thousands of samples from what is now thought to be a massive hidden aquifer stretching from New Jersey as far north as Maine. Is this one of the many depositories of secret fresh water known to exist in shallow salt waters around the world that might someday be tapped to slake the planet's intensifying thirst, said Brandon Dugan, the expedition's co-chief scientist. We need to look for every possibility we have to find more water for society, Dugan, a geophysicist and hydrologist at the Colorado School of Mines, told Associated Press journalists who recently spent 12 hours on the drilling platform. The research teams looked at one of the last places you would probably look for fresh water on Earth. They found it and will be analyzing nearly 13,209 gallons of it back in their labs around the world in the coming months. They're out to solve the mystery of its origins, whether the water is from glaciers, connected underground water systems on land, or some combination. The potential is enormous. So are the hurdles of getting the water out and puzzling over who owns it, who uses it, and how to extract it without undue harm to nature. It's bound to take years to bring that water ashore for public use in a big way, if it's even feasible. Why try? In just 5 years, the UN says, the global demand for fresh water will exceed supplies by 40%. Rising sea levels from the warming climate are souring coastal fresh water sources, while data centers that power AI and cloud computing are continue consuming water at an insatiable rate. The fabled Ancient Mariner's lament, "Water, water everywhere, not a drop to drink," looms as a warning to landlubbers as well as to sailors on salty seas. In Virginia alone, a quarter of all power produced in the state goes to data centers, a share expected to nearly double in 5 years. By some estimates, each mid-sized data center consumes as much water as 1,000 households. Each of the Great Lakes states has experienced groundwater shortages. Cape Town, South Africa, came perilously close to running out of fresh water for its nearly 5 million people in 2018 during an epic 3-year drought. South Africa is thought to have a coastal undersea freshwater bonanza too, and there is at least an anecdotal evidence that every continent may have the same. Canada's Prince Edward Island, Hawaii, and Jakarta, Indonesia, are among places where stressed freshwater supplies coexist with prospective aquifers under the ocean. Enter Expedition 501, a $25 million scientific collaboration of more than a dozen countries backed by the U.S. government's National Science Foundation and the European Consortium for Ocean Research Drilling. U.S. money for it was secured before budget cuts sought by the Trump administration. Scientists went into the project believing that undersea aquifer they were sampling might be sufficient to meet the needs of metropolitan the size of New York City for 800 years. They found fresh or nearly fresh water at both higher and lower depths below the seafloor than they anticipated, suggesting a larger supply even than that. Their work at sea unfolded over 3 months from lifeboat Robert, an ocean-growing vessel that once on site lowers three enormous pillars to the seafloor and squats above the waves. Normally a service's offshore petroleum sites and wind farms, this drill baby drill mission was different. It's known that this phenomena exists both here and elsewhere around the world. Expedition 501 project manager Jez Everest, a scientist who came from the British Geological Survey in Edinburgh, Scotland, said of undersea water, "But it's a subject that's never been directly investigated by any research project in the past." By that, he means no one globally had drilled systematically into the seabed on a mission to find fresh water. Expedition 501 was quite literally groundbreaking. It penetrated Earth below the sea by up to nearly 1,300 feet. But it followed a 2015 research project that mapped contours of an aquifer remotely using electromagnetic technology and roughly estimated salinity of the water underneath. That mission by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University reported evidence of a massive offshore aquifer system in this area, possibly rivaling the size of America's largest, the Ogallala Aquifer, which supplies water to parts of 8 Great Plains states. Two developments in 1976 had stirred interest in searching for undersea fresh water. In the middle of Nantucket Island, U.S. Geological Survey drilled a test well to see how far down the groundwater went. It extracted fresh water from such great depths that it made scientists wonder if the water came from the sea, not the sky. The same year, that federal agency mounted a 60-day expedition aboard the drilling vessel Glomar Conception along a vast stretch of the continental shelf from Georgia to George's Bank off New England. It drilled cores in search of the subseabed's resources, like methane. It found an eye-opening amount of fresh or freshened water in borehole after borehole. That set the stage for the water seekers to do their work a half century later. Soon after Robert arrived at the first of three drilling sites, May 19th, samples drawn from below the seabed registered salinity of just 4 parts per thousand. That's far below the ocean's average salt content of 35 parts per thousand, but still too briny to meet the U.S. freshwater standard of under 1 part per thousand. Four parts per thousand was a eureka moment, Dugan said, because the finding suggested that the water must have been connected to a terrestrial system in the past or still is. As the weeks wore on and Robert moved from site to site 20 to 30 miles off the coast, the process of drilling into the waterlogged subsea sediment yielded a collection of samples down to one part per thousand salt content. Some were even lower. Bingo, that's what you find in many bodies of fresh water on land. That's water you can drink. In theory, no one did. In months of analysis ahead, the scientists will investigate a range of properties of the water, including what microbes were living in the depths, what they used for nutrients and energy sources, and what byproducts they might generate. In other words, whether the water is safe to consume or otherwise use. Techniques will also be used to determine whether it came from a glacial ice melt thousands of years ago or is still coming via labyrinth geologic formations from land. Researchers will date the water back to in the lab, and that will be a key in determining whether it is a renewable resource that would be used responsibly. Primordial water is trapped and finite. Newer water suggests the aquifer is still connected to a terrestrial source and being refreshed, however slowly. Younger means it was a raindrop 100 years ago, 200 years ago, Dugan said. If young, it's recharging. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Don with News and Review. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.